This open question and answer session was led by Ron Julian on January 27, 2008 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2008. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, well, so you asked for it, so what do you want to talk about? Have some questions about anything that I could answer or anybody else here could answer? I know this is hitting you quickly here, so you need a minute to think about what it is you might want to talk about. There's Margaret's hand back there. Thanks, Margaret. We'll prime the pump here.
This is just a suggestion. We don't have to talk about this. But one thing I regularly am flabbergasted and confused and befuddled by is when elections come up, trying to pick a candidate, because there don't seem to be any good choices, only less bad choices. And I'm not necessarily interested in a discussion of the specific candidates, only how do you approach looking at candidates, and if you've got a finite amount of time and can't do all this research and have to depend upon, you know, I'd be interested in anybody's who has ideas about how to go about doing that, because I find myself in the situation where when I finally pick somebody to vote for, if I let anybody know what that is, half the wise people I know are going to say, yeah, and half the wise people I know are going to go, are you kidding? So I don't, you know, some people seem to think they know how to pick a good candidate, but I'm not one of them.
I'll tell you what I'm going to do with that question. I'm going to take that question and I'm going to hold it in reserve. Okay, so we may, in fact, discuss that. Part of the reason I'm holding it as reserve is that I personally have nothing to say about that topic. So, I mean, if you all have great wisdom on that topic, we can have that discussion. But I haven't ignored it. It's right here on the back burner, ready to come up front at any moment. But that's one possibility for something we might talk about, which is a very interesting topic.
Okay. I heard this question asked on a radio program to Ravi Zacharias.
Mm-hmm.
And that was after 9/11. It was very clearly obvious that the gentleman who flew planes into a building had very strong convictions about their faith. And in the years that followed that, I found myself really feeling a little shaky about things because I at times don't necessarily have that strong a conviction about my own faith. And I think, well, if we're Christians and Jesus is the only way and we're in the right, you know, that guy doesn't think so. So it really was a question of how do we know that we're right? You know, we can't grab it like we could grab this chair. And, you know, so when we're surrounded in a world that believes all these different things, what gives us the true conviction that we really, like I said, we're in the right?
Right. Okay, well, but let's talk about that a little bit. And there are different aspects to what you brought up there. It seems to me that, I mean, this is actually something I've been thinking about for a long time. It seems to me that we embrace a picture of the world. We have this model in our heads of this is the way things are. And we process the things in the world according to that model. I mean, certain things that people might tell me, I don't even bother to think about it. It's just, no, that's not right. Because it comes into my picture of the world and it so obviously does not fit my picture that I just reject it out of hand. That, I think, is is human nature. That is the way we're designed. It's supposed to be that way. We couldn't possibly function if every time somebody came along and said something that was different than what I think, I threw away everything I thought and said, oh my gosh, maybe they're right. I could never get from point A to point B. I mean, it is appropriate for us to have a certain conservatism about our set of beliefs. That, yeah, okay. But at the same time, as I go through life, I experience these places where there can be a kind of a tension. You know, I come across things that don't fit my picture of the world, maybe, but I don't quite have a good answer for, you know, an issue has been raised here, and I'm kind of troubled by it. I can't explain the problem in terms of my worldview, but I'm not ready yet to kind of throw everything away, but I kind of recognize, you know, I have this tension. It can be a personal experience. It can be living life and going along and finding myself less and less satisfied with the way my life is going, and somehow the things that I have embraced as valuable and so on, I look at them and say, you know, this isn't working somehow. And so there comes that point at which, if enough of that kind of builds up, that I'm start to, the way I think about it is, I'm in the market for a new worldview. I'm willing to consider the possibility that the reason I can't make sense of my life or my experience or something that's out there is because the picture I have right now is not in keeping with reality. And so I'm bumping up against reality is causing stress and tension in my worldview, and that's what's making me unhappy. I mean, if I were to adapt and actually decide, you know, this is in fact the way things are, all of a sudden things would fall into place in a different way. Okay, so I understand our decision to embrace, to believe the gospel, to hear the proclamation of the gospel and say, yeah, that's true, to be a thing like that, where for whatever reason, because of our own sense of unhappiness and guilt, or a looking for meaning and purpose in my life that I'm not finding in the approach to things that I'm taking and so on, there comes this point at which it makes sense to me that I would abandon the picture of the world that I have and embrace this one instead. Okay? So why do I put this model out there? It seems to me then that what is appropriate is for us to both pursue the things that we believe to be true and live in the light of them and make our decisions in the light of those things, and yet at the same time to have a certain humility that recognizes, you know, I had to change my mind before, and so what I don't want to do is hide from reality. If people raise an issue that is a good question, I don't want to wave it away and say, oh, I don't have to think about that. I just have to recognize, well, to be a person of integrity, I need to recognize that I don't have an answer to that question, and I'm not going to abandon what I think because I don't have an answer to that question, but I'm going to acknowledge that that's the case and think about it, and as I go through my life, if those questions keep piling up, maybe I should think about them, and maybe I need to make some adjustments and that kind of thing. So there are ways of believing things, of being deeply committed to one's beliefs that are not rooted in a desire to have my picture of reality fit the way things are, and with that kind of humility that says I want to change my mind if I'm wrong about this. But there are incentives, there are reasons why we might deeply commit ourselves to a particular way of looking at things, because we're so invested in the particular thing that we get from that we're going to hang on to it no matter what. So, in part, I'm not necessarily bothered by the fact, I know what you're talking about. There are people out there, there are religious people that make me look like a totally irreligious person. person. I mean, in comparison, I am a total pagan. Or, I mean, in comparison to, I mean, I'm talking about Christians and Muslims and all kinds of religious people out there who have, they have gone for it in such a way that, you know, they're going to bowl you right over as they go past because they're on the highway to, you know. So, but the strength of conviction that motivates that is not necessarily something I want to emulate. Maybe it is, but it might just be that, I mean, if you ever have a conversation with one of those really true believers in something where you can't make any progress at all. I mean, you try to say, well, wouldn't you at least acknowledge that this is a little bit of a problem that we ought to think about? And if, no, push it away, no. And the fact that they won't, the fact that they just won't even talk to you sort of indicates that there's an investment in this thing that maybe is a little stronger than, that it's rooted in something other than that desire to figure out what's true. So, I mean, I would argue that our faith, we believe it because it, we look at the proclamation of the gospel. To me, I look at it and it makes sense of who I am and the world I live in. It explains a lot of things. It explains the order in the world. It explains how is it that I can understand the way the world is? Well, I can understand it because the world was created by God and I was created by God, and so my mind and heart are made in such a way that it fits and can make sense of the world around me. And all of those kinds of things, all of that picture together says to me, this, I'm convinced. I think when Paul says this stuff that he's saying in his letter, I think he's right. I mean, this is true. He said that God came to him and explained this stuff about Jesus and what the point of creation is. And it is interesting that, as we're going to see when we do get to the 2 Corinthians stuff next time, is that Paul is rooting the things that he's saying in a pretty deep understanding of a theme that has been running through the Old Testament from the beginning. You know, so there's a great integrity and coherence to this message, besides which it makes sense of my life. So I don't know if that, I kind of meandered around, but that's kind of how I would think about that question. I think you're right. There is a kind of appropriate humility. It's not necessarily a bad thing that sometimes we would back up and say, okay, well, that person seems to be more convinced than I am about this stuff, and maybe that's okay. Yeah, so, David?
But adding to that, so if we look at, you know, kind of extreme action, extreme religious actions, you know, like we can say, well, that terrorist attack was an outgrowth of extreme religious belief, you know, or, you know, very severe ascetic behavior, you know, like somebody who, you know, has very limited, you know, diet or will not touch food for, you know, weeks and weeks at a time. You say, well, this is extreme religious behavior. I wish that I believed like that. Well, I mean, you don't wish that you believed like that. I mean, because those are actions that are not related to our convictions, you know. So it's easy to look at that kind of behavior and say, wow, that's really amazing, you know. But it's important not to be confused about it because, you know, it's amazing, sure, but it's also horrible, you know. I mean, that's not what we're called to do at all, you know. And, you know, people have deep conviction about all kinds of things. Throw religion out the window, and people have deep conviction about, you know, we need to go and invade this country and kill everybody, you know. So, well, that's not, you know, okay, we can admire, you know, somebody's conviction, maybe in an abstract sense, but, you know, people are totally convinced about something that is, you know, that we're pretty sure is totally wrong, you know. But I think that a point that you made, you know, that bears stressing is that, you know, if we're totally convinced of our beliefs, well, what is our belief? Our belief is that, you know, is that the truth exists and that we have to conform our thoughts and behavior towards it, you know. And that means changing your mind. And that means being, you know, being holding true to what you know is right, you know, but jettisoning things that are not right. You know, so if you feel like, oh, well, I don't know what in my belief system, you know, is really true and what isn't, you know, that's a call to assess what you believe. And the things that you know are true, we should exhort one another in those things. And absolutely, we should have the same force of convictions that those people had, you know. But fortunately, thank God, you know, those convictions don't lead to violence against other human beings. And they don't lead to violence against our own selves, you know. But no, totally. I mean, I can see where you're coming from. And you say, well, while those are courageous people, you know, but we also should be courageous people, but it
right.
Express itself in a very different way.
Yeah, and that's a very good point. Is I think I could say that there is a qualitative difference between the kind of belief we're talking about. But you're right. Our beliefs, a conviction in us is going to lead to a different kind of thing. I mean, a deep conviction of Christian faith ought to lead us to a certain humility about our own selves, because that's a deep part of what it is we're convinced is true. So, yeah, that's good.
Yeah, I was sympathizing because I think I've had enough experiences with people where they'll say, like, you know, they'll it's not Islam per se, but they'll, in Christian circles, say, well, I did this or that and the other, whether it's going on this huge mission trip or fasting for who knows how long. And it's so hard because there is an initial knee-jerk reaction within myself of, like, I suck. You know, like, I'm such a Christian loser. Because I don't do anything extreme at all, you know. I mean, at all, especially these days. And I have nothing extreme about the outside of my life. But it's like, to me, it seems like the most where I feel like, well, I feel like the crucible is really like being a dad and being a husband and having friends. Because that's where I feel like an extremist. You know what I mean? Because I blow it, but then wrestle with it and occasionally make wise choices in that context. But it's really easy to, you know, throw a cross on your back and walk across the country or something like that compared to not being a jerk. I mean, that to me is the hardest thing in the world.
Yes.
And so to me, it's like if there's anything extreme about Christianity, is that it? I mean, is that where it's at? Because sometimes, you know, like I said, that knee-jerk reaction calls it into question. Like, well, maybe I'm just totally, you know, I eat too much or whatever. I don't fast enough.
Yeah. And now, I mean, let's say we don't want to put ourselves on the other side and say, you can tell that I'm the greatest disciple of Christ because I'm real middle of the road with everything. I mean, it's not exactly what we're talking about either. I mean, there may come that point where, I mean, in pursuing both the nature of my own call before God as what my life ought to be about, or the particular circumstances that I have been brought to, I may come to a place where I have to take a stand or make a decision that's going to look to the world around us like, wow, that person is an extremist. I mean, they're really taking this far, you know, that he would give up a job that pays that much, or that he would live in this way, or he would forgive the person who did this terrible thing, or, you know, whatever that thing might be. I mean, what we want to do is pursue the implications of our faith. But I agree with you. Most of the time, the implications of our faith are there to be explored in the very context that we find ourselves. Am I going to forgive? Am I going to care about the other person? Am I going to, in this relationship, try to encourage things that are mutually beneficial? Or are we going to pursue what is superficial? And, I mean, all of those kinds of things, our discipleship works itself out everywhere.
And I'm thinking about, like, also, what you're saying, it's almost like there's a natural rhythm, like, that God creates within us. I mean, I don't want to get woo-woo, but I think...
It's okay. Go ahead and get woo-woo.
I just did. but I want to say, I mean, it's like Jesus with his apostles not fasting and things like that, and they were on a different... They had a different rhythm, but there was a responsiveness to righteousness that was not there with the Pharisees. So I look back, you know, a couple years ago, left the job I had that was much more secure than what I went and did. But it was like, I have no, where else, this is it. This is like, there's this deep conviction that God's in control and I can do this and it's going to be fine or not fine, but it's going to be how God wants it to be. And there's like this kind of rhythm that takes over. Now, does that mean that everyone should leave their job? No, because that's different. But there's this fine line between saying, hey, whatever you want to do is cool, and having that deep conviction that, no, this is God's calling in my life right now, is to be a certain way in life. And
Great. Okay, it's up here. And then Margaret had her hand up, too.
What do we do with Jesus saying that, in this world you'll have trouble, but take heart, I've overcome the world, and statements that he made like, if you want to follow me, it's going to be rough, he said. The Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head, and if you want to follow me, you're not going to either. And I know some of that stuff directly applied to the apostles and disciples at this time, but it feels like there is this kind of impetus from Christ that if you want to follow me, it isn't going to be easy. And I think that maybe Christians bring a lot of stuff on themselves because they want to fit that mold, if you will. But what's the truth about those statements?
Right. Well, I like what you said there at the end. I think we have to distinguish between in this world you will have trouble, and in order to be my disciple, you should bring as much trouble upon yourself as you can, because then everybody will know that you're really following me. It's what he's saying is, I think, and a lot of those statements are really focused on the fact, I think, that like he says, if they hate me, they're going to hate you. I mean, basically, that what he is about is not attractive in many ways to the natural man, to the person of this world who is not interested, who has pushed aside the knowledge of God. And there are going to come those places where for us to follow Christ means that we're going to be swimming upstream. And I think that's true. We will encounter that in all variety of ways. I mean, it's interesting that when Jesus describes the cost of discipleship, one of the things he says is that you have to hate father and mother. Okay, and what he means by that is, he uses that language, I have brought a sword. And what he's saying is, even in a family situation where the natural dynamic is we are together, we are a family, we're on each other's side, embracing the gospel may alienate those who you would otherwise be your support and comfort and help in life. Now they are against you, they may not be beating you up, but there is this rift that has come, and if you're going to be faithful to the gospel, then there's, in a sense, there's a rift that just cannot be healed. I mean, there's a place beyond which you can't go at that spot. And that's a kind of trouble that I think that he's talking about, that there is this reaction in the world. So, yeah, that, I think, I would understand all those statements to be basically a statement of reality. This is the way it will be. I don't have to go looking for it. It will find me if I am, in fact, pursuing the gospel.
I've heard it said, if it doesn't find you, maybe you're not really a believer.
Well, yeah, but... yeah, I don't see the Bible saying if you're not having trouble, you're a believer. Maybe somebody can correct me, but I don't really see that as a theme. What I see it saying is, if to avoid trouble, you abandon your discipleship and will not throw in your lot with me, Jesus is saying, then, yeah, that's not what we're talking about. But it depends on the circumstances that I'm in. I mean, if I'm in a family, if I grew up in a family where the people in the family are committed Christians, and that can happen, then the one kind of trouble I'm not going to experience is my following Jesus ends up being a thing that divides me off from my family. And some people have that experience. But in their family, they have a safe harbor, but I mean, who knows the kind of things? I mean, it can even happen in churches. I mean, we are all familiar with those situations where in a particular church setting, maybe the leadership or the kind of the cool folks in the community are kind of not really committed to the gospel as it is laid out in the Bible, and someone will start to try to say, well, but isn't this what it's all about? And all of a sudden, you're being divisive and you're causing trouble and that kind of stuff. And here it is, it's happened right in the midst of people who say they're following Jesus. I mean, I think that's what Paul is saying in 1 Corinthians when he talks about that he says, I hear there are divisions among you, and in part I believe it. And I think what he's saying is that ultimately those who are actually in fact committed to the gospel are going to end up standing out, and you can't help that. To a certain extent, that's just going to happen. So all of that stuff, I think, finds us. And I really do think that's the issue, is that not that we go looking for it, but that we don't get out of its way. I think it's that. Yeah.
Doug Groteis, who used to teach for the Study Center, was fond of saying, we're supposed to be fools for Christ, not idiots for Christ. And it seems like if people are getting on your case, it can be because you're a fool for Christ, but it could also be because you're being an idiot for Christ. Mm-hmm. And we need to be the fool, not the idiot. But with what we were talking about, I guess back to the original the question, it seems like there's something in our culture that that puts a value on passion no matter what its object. So people who are passionate about anything are to be admired. And so it always kind of makes me simultaneously chuckle and cringe when I go to some of these places where they have inspirational plaques, and one of the plaques is believe. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, in what?
Right.
You know, why is just believing without specifying what I'm believing in some kind of virtue? I think it's because this idea that if you're passionate, it doesn't really matter particularly what you're passionate about. Just as long as you're passionate, that's what we want.
Yeah.
So that's the bad side. On the good side, I think we also admire people who are willing to do what they think is right, even when it hurts them. And so I think of somebody like in Chariots of Fire with the guy who wouldn't run in the Olympics or whatever it was, because it was the Sabbath and he believed that you shouldn't do work on the Sabbath. Well, I disagree with his understanding of the Sabbath, but I am in total admiration of his willingness to give up this thing that was so clearly important to him because he believed God wanted him to behave in a particular way.
Right.
So, So here's...
Yeah, that's true.
I have a question that given that there is a sense in which... There's a sense in which the truth per se, or the arriving at truth, successful arriving at all truth, is actually, it seems like it's in a sense kind of almost irrelevant. I don't want to say it's irrelevant, but one's attitude towards truth is more significant than one's ability to arrive at it. And so you have statements in the Bible where I think it's Paul says, you know, accept your brother, but not for the purposes of passing judgment on his opinions. For who are you to judge the servant of another? To his own master he stands or falls, and stand he will, for the Lord is able to make him stand. So you've got somebody who's fundamentally committed to the truth, but his current ability to accurately perceive the truth, as evidenced by the fact that he disagrees with me on something, his understanding of the truth is wanting, as is probably the case for everybody.
Well, let me just put into what you're saying there that obviously in that context that you're talking about in Romans, Paul believes that there is a right answer to that question, that the ones who think that they have an obligation not to eat, that in fact they're mistaken, that they have the freedom to eat, and they have put a religious obligation on themselves that they do not actually have. And yet, even though he himself would come down on one side of it and say there is in fact the right answer to this, he is saying, but don't, you know, accept each other and don't pass judgment on each other's opinions.
Passing judgment meaning don't, not that you shouldn't tell, try to persuade the other person that this is a better way of thinking about things, but passing judgment in the sense to say, you are damned. I know you are damned because you can't get 80% or better on your catechism exam kind of thing. So is it possible, I was reading something the other day with somebody whose political and philosophical commitments I disagree with, but what was interesting was he was criticizing other people in his philosophical camp for lying in order to promote certain perspectives. He said, these perspectives are correct and should be embraced, but they should not be promoted by using lies. And I thought, you know, I feel more like, more related to this particular person than I do to all sorts of other people who they call themselves Christians, and I call, and maybe they are, and I call myself a Christian, but when I watch them, how their relationship with the truth, they don't seem to value truth. I mean, they say they do, but when you bring up something that looks like maybe Christianity isn't right, or, you know, some argument, it's like their minds, they are not interested in it, and it looks like they're not interested in it, because if you could prove to them that God didn't exist and Christianity was wrong, they would not be interested in it. And I don't think that person is a brother if they're believing things for the wrong reason. So my question is, when Jesus says the truth shall set you free, I'm these days inclined to think what he means by that is one's attitude towards the truth. If you are genuinely, truly committed to the truth, whether or not you've actually succeeded in arriving at it at this, any particular time in your life, if it is true about you that you are committed to the truth, God is much more interested in that than he is that you can get 80% or better on your catechism test.
Okay.
So, what do you think?
Well, I agree very much with everything you said, except that very last bit about what Jesus meant in the thing about the truth setting you free. Actually, I could be wrong, but I have a different picture of what's happening there. But let me back up first and say I really like what you're saying. That's what makes things like, I mean, what we see in Galatians with the problem of the Judaizers and that sort of thing. Here are people who were saying Jesus is the Christ, and yet Paul was saying, if you receive circumcision, Christ will be of no benefit to you. Meaning, I think, okay, you've accepted that Jesus is the Christ, but you've accepted it on different terms than the terms that he is actually the Christ. I mean, you have married that with a picture of finding acceptance before God because you have obeyed all of these Jewish laws that ultimately the reason that God accepts you is because you have done a good job. And he's saying it's having that disposition that is prepared to believe, yeah, in the end, the reason that God likes me better than he likes them is because I've done a good job and they haven't. That attitude totally mitigates against the fact that on the true-false test, you would answer the question, is Jesus the Christ? Yes. I mean, as you say, you're saying yes for a different reason, and that's not really what it's about. And I think that's very important, that the having eyes to see is and ears to hear, that's where the focus of this is, being a person who actually can see and acknowledge the reality of one's own sin, and that's why the message of a Savior who brings me forgiveness and rescue from my own evil means something to me, and I believe it because I am willing to acknowledge that's the case, which I was not willing to acknowledge before, and it's that willingness to see the truth of things in a profound way, that's what's important. And that, at first, can look quite messy. I mean, when first a person first becomes a Christian, oftentimes their beliefs are a strange mixture of all the stuff they used to think and some new things, and it can, and this is why we talk about the maturing of our faith in part, is that part of it is a maturing of our understanding as we start to come to see more what it's about. But I am not more a child of God when my faith has matured and I have a better understanding than I was when I didn't have much understanding at all, but I was willing to acknowledge that I needed what the gospel was offering. So, yeah, I agree with that. I do think, though, that Jesus is speaking in terms of discipleship in that section in John about the truth setting you free. If you abide in my word, he says. And I think what he's saying is that I am, in fact, the messenger from God, among other things, the messenger from God who has the thing that you need to know and understand. You know, that if to abide in his word means that I have that kind of heart that you're talking about, I stay and I keep listening, even though it's hard and even though it tells me I'm a sinner and even though all kinds of things are would tend to push me away, I stay and I keep being his disciple and learning from him because I believe he has the truth. And he's saying, ultimately, the truth that I have will lead to freedom. And it's the only way you're going to find freedom is through what I have to offer. So I think there's room there for the picture that you're describing, because the issue is having a heart that will abide, that will stay and hear out what it is he has to say. But I do think he's talking about ultimately the goal of this, the end result of this process is you will arrive at the truth of things. You will come to know yourself for who you are and God for who he is in a way that if you don't follow and abide in my teaching, you will be a fool and lost and you will believe lies. That's how I would integrate kind of the picture you have with what he said in that way.
So when he says, set you free, does he mean my own way of thinking about myself is I was a slave before and now I am free? Or does he, it seems like it's such an ambiguous statement. Is the freedom what's ultimately going to happen to me when I'm redeemed and I am free from sin? Is it the freedom, my attitude about my state before God? Is it all of the above?
Well, yeah, there's a certain amount of ambiguity to it. I mean, I think it has an element that I'm looking at in this life and ultimately beyond, because they object, the Jews object, we're not slaves, we don't need to be freed. And he says, everyone who sins is a slave of sin. So I think what he's, the freedom that he's talking about is our ultimate freedom from our own sin. And in the gospel, I find first forgiveness for my sin and ultimately release from my sin. And I think it's that whole picture. So to be his disciple, I will ultimately arrive at a total freedom. And so I think it does, I would see it as pointing ultimately to, but it's not that freedom hasn't begun, because already I am forgiven and already my perspective on life is being transformed. I am already, as being his disciple for several years, I am more in touch with the truth than I was before I was his disciple. So it has begun, but ultimately I think the freedom that he's talking about is what I'm learning from him is that I can't solve my own problem. And he is teaching that he has come to solve my problem, and I'm looking to him to solve my problem. And that's where the freedom is going to come. I think that's how I would look at it.
Maybe switching gears just a little bit.
Sure.
It's kind of a big question. I can't really answer it completely, but I've been thinking about there's somewhere, I don't even know exactly where it is, in Paul's letters where he talks about where he's kind of admonishing whatever community he's writing to and saying, let's not do we need to return to feeding on milk as opposed to solid food kind of thing? And I sometimes find myself just sort of going around in circles, like dealing with the same issues and the same problems and struggles, and it sometimes feels like I want it to be all or nothing. It's like I want to be completely, you know, victorious, an arrival point, or just forget about it, you know. And it's sometimes hard for me to feel a sense of progress, you know, because it's like we're sinners, and so that's never going to change. And yet it seemed, you know, until the next age, when we'll be completely recreated, or yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I guess just a general question of what is he getting at, maybe in that, wherever he is talking about that, and how do you, I mean, we don't become better people or better Christians. I mean, that's not something that makes sense to me, but there, it seems like there should be a sense of progress and a sense of, 10 years ago it was, you know, things were kind of like this, and now things are different, and I improved in this way, or I see things that, you know what I mean? Yeah. And what kinds of things should we be looking, you know, should we be hoping to improve right. on, and which kinds of things it's like, well, that's just always going to be there, you know? Right.
That aspect of your question, I actually have a kind of an answer to. I didn't quite catch, though, at the beginning, you talked about the milk and solid food. How did that, I didn't catch how that related to the question that you asked there in the end. Are you thinking that he's saying something about that issue there?
Yeah, it seems like he's saying, you know, we've already been here and done that. Do I need to go over this with you again? You know, maybe I'm misreading it. It's like, you guys haven't moved beyond milk. You're still infants. Okay. And you should be. Maybe I'm reading my own.
Right. Okay. Well, I actually was going to say, I was wondering, for those of you that came in late, you can see that I'm just kind of taking questions on whatever. Jack, I was wondering if you'd like to come up and join me and maybe make whatever comments you have. And in particular, I know I think you've looked at that passage in Hebrews that talks about the milk and solid food stuff more than I have. So I asked Jack to speak to that and whatever he wants to say about your question, and then in general I have a comment about your question too.
Well, the milk and solid food, he's really actually talking about Jewish believers who have at one point or another thrown in their lot with Christians, and what he's concerned about is they're actually beginning to go back on and reject some of the fundamental teachings of the gospel itself. And that what he's calling the milk is actually the preparatory material in the what we call the Old Testament that kind of lay the groundwork for understanding the gospel. And what he's needing to proclaim again in the book of Hebrews is the gospel. And he's just astonished that they're not even grasping adequately the preparatory material in the Old Testament. So that's the milk and solid food thing. I don't think that has anything to do with the way you live or your choices or your maturity or anything of the sort there.
Does the Bible address this in some way, a sense of progress? I probably heard that passage being used to discuss the phases of Christian life, and probably if what you're saying is true, then they're pulling it out of context and not really.
Well, I think it probably does in a variety of ways. For example, it makes a distinction between those who are what it calls teleos and those of you who are not teleos. And teleos is having arrived at your telos. And I would argue that the telos he has in mind there is the end of the process, the goal of the process of sanctification. And I take the goal of the process of sanctification to have reached a point, a kind of a point of no return in your commitment to the truth of the gospel. you're not just trying it out any longer. You're not just intrigued by it. You're not just there as long as it's working and there as long as it's convenient. You're there because it's true. That's the person, I think, who's teleos. And that is a process, and you do grow in that, and it has implications for the way you live and your lifestyle and all that kind of stuff. So something approximately like what you're talking about is valid. However, we have to be really careful, I think. When I evaluate myself, I'm going to be inclined to focus on those incredible failures in my life. If I'm at all sensitive to the demands of the gospel, I'm going to focus on the failures. And I think what's significant is that sanctification is in God's hands. It's not something that I'm supposed to do for God. It's something that is in God's hands. He's doing it in me. And one of the reasons I may not be making any real progress in some area of colossal failure is because he's working elsewhere. He's not wanting to give me victory. He's wanting to give me humility, for example. And that softness and that tenderness and that, you know, kind of beating down that pride is a huge part of sanctification. And if it takes my living with my failure in the meantime until that happens, that's God's business. You know, that's not mine. So we can get a distorted picture when we introspectively look at ourselves. We can get a distorted picture of what's going on because we're not even focused on the real progress that God is making in us.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I mean, you guys hear me talk about this all the time, but I'm really convinced that the fundamental picture of, I mean, I'm sure there are other ways that it can happen, but the thing that I see the Bible describing and that I feel like I have seen at work in my own life and many people's life is this process of going through what the Bible calls trials. That is, going through situations that force me to actually confront whether the gospel means something to me or not. Maybe there's something that I really want and God has withheld it from me. Or maybe there's something I really don't want and God clearly could take it away and he doesn't. Maybe it's a loss. There are all kinds of things that can happen. Maybe it's a failure in my own life. I like to think of myself as pretty much having it together and I end up doing this terrible thing. And I have to ask the question, what does the gospel really mean to me? Do I really acknowledge that I'm a sinner and rejoice that God has been merciful to me? Or have I always kind of just thought that actually I'm pretty okay and I give lip service to that sinner stuff? Do I actually believe that what I really need is for to be forgiven and to have God be at work in my life and ultimately bring me into his kingdom of righteousness? Or does I kind of play lip service to that and what I really think I need is a really good job and a whole bunch of people around me that think I'm great, you know, or whatever it is I'm longing for in this life. And it's in the midst of working those things out, I come up against, I really, really want this to be the nature of my life and God gives me a different kind of life than that, that I have to stop and ask, what do I think about this? And I think many of us could testify that it was in the midst of those kinds of experiences that, you know, it's where the rubber meets the road, that we started to have to think, okay, what does this really mean to me in the end? And that, I think, I mean, I'm not saying that's the only way that God sanctifies us, but it is the one that is described the most in the Bible. And I think you can think about the letters that Paul wrote as being, in a sense, calling on the people that he's writing to in the midst of the particular trials that they're in to actually make that step of really believing that this thing is true and looking at their situation in the light of that instead of forgetting that that's true and going off and pursuing something else. So I think in that sense, I could point you to many believers that I have known who over time would say, okay, on the one hand, you know, I have problems in my life that I have struggled with my entire life, and I'm still struggling with them. But on the other hand, I have seen these places where I have come to this place of commitment, where I made this decision, no, this is what I really want. And, you know, my life has never been the same since that point. I have never gone back and doubted whether I really wanted this or not, because I confronted that issue there and God showed me what he was doing in my life and it really came to mean something to me. That's how I picture what that progress would look like. And so what you will see is I see things about myself that were, I wish were different, but they're not, and they're still the same as they were before. But on the other hand, the gospel means more to me than it used to be, and I'm actually a little bit more humble about things than I used to be, because I have come to see through experience how much I have to be humble about and how great God is in his mercy and all of that. And those things have grown even as other things have gone nowhere. That's how I would picture that. So, yeah, I would agree with Jack. You have to watch out. If we interpret Christian growth as the freedom from moral struggles or something like that, then it's hard to find, I think, it's hard to find mature believers. Because I've never, when I see a mature believer, one of the characteristics of that maturity is an honesty about where they really stand. And that honesty leads them to acknowledge, I'm not what I ought to be. And it's still a case. It's not what I want. It's not that I'm not struggling and fighting against that, but it's still a struggle and it's still a fight. And you'd think after all these years that I'd have this together. Well, after all these years, I do have something together, but not that. So,
I will say one other thing. A lot of times what really bothers us is addictive type of behavior, being addicted to one kind of evil or another. And I don't think there's any magic answer to that. I mean, there are a lot of theological systems that have tried to offer, you know, the power of the Spirit. If you'll just walk by the Spirit, and the power of the Spirit will give you victory. It's a very attractive idea, but I really don't think it's the biblical idea on the one hand. On the other hand, I think there is a kind of empowerment that comes over time. Unfortunately, it doesn't come quickly and immediately. But the more and more I become convinced that the values of the Bible are true, the less interesting everything else looks. And as the other ways of living my life become less and less interesting, they lose their grip on us and their power on us. So I don't think we're doomed for the rest of our life under the sun to live the slavery that we live right now. I mean, if we're addicted to certain behaviors, I don't think that's the case. But there's no immediate, instantaneous answer. It takes working with the truth, like Ron is talking about, and becoming convinced through the trials and hardships and suffering and tribulation of life that this really is true. There is nothing else, and this is what I want. I mean, it has to work on my desires. I really do want this. I really do want my life to be governed by this and defined by this. And the stronger that becomes, the weaker any other thing can have a grip on us, I think.
The only thing I was going to say, or kind of go on what you're saying, for me, I feel like I struggle with the same issues over and over, and it does, I understand how he feels, because I feel the same way, but the only caveat that's in it for me is I feel like, well, at least I see some choices that maybe 10 years ago I would have gone down that path, and I realize that's a dead end, not even going there. So that's maybe the only little kind of ring of comfort I can kind of hold on to sometimes.
About 20 years ago, Jack did a talk on this, and if I completely ruin what beautiful thing you said, forgive me, but it just played out so truly in my life. You talked teaching on the knee-jerk person, that person doesn't really go away for our whole lives. I mean, God works on that person and gives us other situations, and we grow, and hopefully in wisdom. But basically, we are born and we die with the knee-jerk person that we are, and that is what God continues to work our whole lives in us. And that was just profound in my what was I? Younger. And it continues to be profound that it's like I will have a situation and it's like, oh my goodness, that still rears its head. It's because that is the integral part of who I am. But God does give me more grace and more experiences to look back on. And I know exactly how you feel. I mean, it's a really frustrating journey at times that you think, okay, I handle it, it's gone, and then it rears its head, and it just can just be shocking. And I just took comfort that that is with me for a long time, that basic knee-jerk person. And that talk that you gave years ago was profound for me, of just having comfort in that.
Yeah, I think our very personalities, are not neutral. They're just an incredibly complex mess of wonderful gifts and talents given to us by God and evil. And evil actually goes clear to the level of affecting my very personality. I mean, I pray to God that I will have a different personality in the kingdom of God, you know, because there are just some aspects of my personality that just are not right. They're just not right. And I won't be ridded of that in this life. But what I can do is learn to trump what comes naturally to me in my personality with what my heart has actually become committed to. My knee-jerk reaction would be to respond this way, but I've come to realize that's wrong. I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to react this way. And that's the best we can have in this lifetime. What we're committed to is one day going to be imbued in my very being and my very personality in the kingdom of God. And there I will be automatically, naturally, and spontaneously, beautifully good. That's the glory that we await.
I was going to change subjects again, so I don't know if you guys wanted to continue on that. And
no, that's
if
great.
So, you can ignore
go
this.
Ahead.
But
go ahead.
I'm not really sure how to ask this. I'm thinking about Christ's death on the cross and kind of what your interpretation is, and it's one of those things that I thought I had figured out, and now I'm wondering what exactly does this mean. And I guess more specifically, growing up in the church and, you know, watching my peers, some of them just be so broken before the Lord and at times just so in love with the Lord, and then they just stray and they stray and they stray, and I just wonder, well, you know, did God die for them, but He knew that they wouldn't ever be completely committed to them, yet sometimes they look like they are, and then they end up not serving Him at all, or I don't know. I don't know if that enough said, and you kind of understand my struggle in this, or...
Talk a little more.
Okay, I guess I don't know if it boils down to the concept of predestination, or... I don't know, I guess just Christ's death on the cross, it was just like, you know, God died for everybody, and, you know, ultimately everybody is going to serve Him. It's just a matter of getting the word out, and that's our job, and that's what I grew up believing, and of course that huge burden of guilt, and I don't know if this is a subject that's been covered here a lot, and I've just missed it, or just kind of wondering about everyone's relationship to God in that way, and, you know, if He died for everyone, then why isn't everyone serving Him?
Okay. Well, let me say a couple things and I'll throw it over to Jack. But actually, the thing that I was going to talk about today and that we will talk about next week is this section where Paul talks about how God displays Him in His triumphal procession, and Paul as an apostle is this fragrance of life to those who are being saved and of death to those who are perishing, that I think it does relate to that predestination thing, and that the picture Paul has is that ultimately, in spite of all of the frustrations and failures in his ministry, the Corinthians, half of them think he's terrible, and he had to go off and skip this great opportunity because he was so upset and all this stuff happening. The fact is that this is God's victory over the world that's happening, that God, and over us. And we are just, even Paul as an apostle, it's not his job to go out there and convince people to join this. It's his job to just display the gospel, and those who have eyes to see and ears to hear will ultimately find their way to it, and those who do not will not. So in that sense, I think, yeah, there is something, there is this real difference that the Bible talks about between the one who is open to, you know, spiritually open to being corrected about their own sin and who God is and all of that, and the one who is not. So in that sense, it could very well be that somebody might initially embrace the gospel. It's like the picture Jesus has about the soils with the different kinds of soils that the seed falls in. And there might be an initial interest, but then ultimately other things are more important and distracting, and they go off after that. Yeah, that can happen. Okay, well, I'm going to let Jack talk about that part of it. Jack is more confident in his answer to that question than I am at this point, so I'm going to let Jack, and I'll just sit in the background going, maybe, I don't know. Let's just put it this way. See, I do want Jack to have a chance to say something to this, but when we ask a question like that, it depends where are you, from what perspective are you looking at this? Okay, what I can say with certainty is that any human being that I'm talking to, I can say to them with complete confidence, God will not turn you away. All you have to do is look at the promise of the gospel and say, that's what I need. Save me. And he will. I mean, it's not a question of, oh, sorry, you know, that was a great appeal and I'd love to, but unfortunately, you're not in the book. So, you know, as much as you'd like in, I can't let you in. Sorry, it doesn't work that way. I mean, from our perspective and our experience, it's entirely a matter of knock and the door will open. That's what it's all about. So in that sense, yes, I can say Christ died for you because there is a forgiveness available for you behind that door. All you got to do is knock. And I can say that with complete confidence. On the other hand, ultimately, I think the biblical picture is not a universalist one. It is not that everybody gets in. It is that there are those who will see that and take it, and those who will not. And in that end, Christ's death ended up being actually productive. It actually led to salvation for the ones who, by the grace of God, have eyes to see and ears to hear. So it depends on what side of it you're on as to how you answer that question. That's how I would say it. Okay.
Yeah. I agree with all that. I would just add one thing that he may not agree with. Most theories of what happened on the cross share a false assumption, I think. And that assumption is that there's some magic that happened when Jesus died. I mean, I cringe. There's that hymn, there's power in the blood. I just cringe at that because it just reinforces a notion that I think is fundamentally false. And that is the power that saves us is the death of Jesus. That actually gets captured by Lewis's Narnia tale, or in the first one, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. The magic that when the witch, the white witch, killed Aslan, and then there was a deeper magic. I mean, he really is working out of that assumption that somehow the death of Jesus actually accomplished something and it was effective to accomplish something that if it hadn't been accomplished, you and I couldn't be saved. I've been reading some N.T. Wright recently, and it just seems to me that his perspective shares that fundamentally flawed assumption that it's the death of Jesus that is the power that saves us. I would argue the power that saves us is nothing more and nothing less than the mercy of God. It's simply the choice of God to be merciful. So what does Jesus' death have to do with it? I would understand Jesus' death to be this incredibly significant event smack dab in the middle of history where Jesus goes to his own death telling us, Jack, this death that I'm going to die, I like don't deserve it. But I'm going to die this death because you do. I'm going to die the death that you deserve to die. You think? And that question, so it poses this fundamental existential question to me. Do I think I am so unworthy that it makes sense that the death he died is what I deserve? And I think faith, belief, is in part, it's more than this, but it's in part looking at that claim that Jesus is making and saying, yeah, I believe that. I believe you're dying the death that I deserve. Now, why is that significant? Because it's an act of contrition. And I think when all is said and done, my salvation is nothing more and nothing less than God choosing to be merciful to me because I'm contrite. And I think I've used this example before, but I just, this mental image I have is my, you know, my young daughter, you know, dumping a sandbox all over the living room or something like that, or writing with crayons all over the wall, and me erupting, you know, me really getting angry. And then a few moments later, her showing up sheepishly with a dandelion, offering me a dandelion. Well, it would melt my heart, but not because I like dandelions. It would melt my heart because of the contrition that is implicit in that. Well, I think my pointing to the cross at the judgment seat going, that's all I have to offer, is my dandelion being offered up to God at the judgment, to which we have the promise that God is going to respond in mercy. He's not going to give me what I deserve. He's going to give me the life that I don't deserve. So that's the power of the cross, is this occasion that God created, that's a universal occasion, this occasion that God created for me to demonstrate my contrition. And in response to that contrition, God has promised me mercy. So that does sort out the sheep from the goats, notice. Some will be contrite, some will not. The power of culture is such that if you're raised in a Christian culture, you can praise Jesus' death on the cross upside down and backwards all day long and not really believe it and not be contrite. And life finds a way of washing you out. It's the people who from the inside really do come to that point of contrition who stay the course. It's not just a cultural belief or value. It's an existential belief.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I like a lot of what, and I don't think you would necessarily disagree with what I'm about to say, but I think there is more to it. I don't know how much more, but I think there is more to it than the opportunity for contrition because of the nature, because it is that picture of Jesus offering his life, taking our place, the punishment that we deserve, that sort of thing. I'm thinking of the language. Now, this is really bold of me to quote Romans at Jack. And he's going to tell me why I'm not understanding this right. But I think, I mean, the part of what informs the way I think about the cross is that language in Romans where Paul talks about God being just and the justifier of the one who believes in Jesus. I don't mean that that necessarily implies that Jesus actually satisfied the demands of justice that God had to. I mean, that's possible, but I'm not sure that it has to go that far. But I think what I see in that is that if God had given another occasion for us to be contrite, that it wouldn't have been as good as Jesus' death, because what we have there is Jesus. It's that picture of God didn't just say, oh, it's okay. You know, just come on in. I'll just forget it. He did something that demonstrated the seriousness of the problem of sin. It needed this kind of thing. So in that sense, he's saying, look, both justice and mercy mean something. I'm not just going to be merciful and forget justice, but I'm not just going to be just and forget mercy. I'm going to do both of these things together. So in that sense, then, at least in picture, it does more than that. And whether that question, I mean, you know, you guys, I mean, this is just another one of the ways that Jack is a heretic, so you just have to take this into account, is that what he just said would get some Christians really, really angry. I mean, there are whole movements out there today that are convinced that one of the biggest problems in the church is losing sight of the reality of the substitutionary atonement and that kind of thing. And I don't know. I'm still kind of going back and forth on that. But I think there is, I do think there's some wisdom in what Jack is saying here. I may in the end go all the way this way, but I think it's important. Part of that language of who Jesus died for is kind of like Jesus' blood is this magic juice, and how far does the magic juice go? And that I don't think is kind of what we're being asked to picture. So, David, you have you've got the mic. Maybe
I just have one short thing. I don't know how relevant this is, but something just kind of snapped into place in my brain, Jack, when you were talking about how you understand Jesus' death. My Old Testament knowledge isn't good at all, but wasn't there some point when Moses had a snake raised and whoever looked at that was saved or something? Mm-hmm. That makes sense. I mean, it seems like the same sort of thing, like the snake wasn't doing anything in particular, but people needed to look at it.
Yeah, well, in fact, and Jesus himself compares, I think, his death on the cross with that event, saying it's the same kind of thing. Now, to what extent is it the same kind of thing, and that can be debated, but that's a good point. I mean, that's exactly the kind of thing that Jack is talking about. That's good. But David had his hand up. We're kind of getting to the end of our time. Let's go to David, and then maybe we should stop.
Thanks. On the topic of substitutionary atonement, it's hard for me to swallow it, honestly, because I don't think it was just. I mean, surely it wasn't just for Jesus, you know, to die like that. But I don't know. I mean, I think sin is a big problem, of course. You know, unrighteousness and wickedness and lying is a big problem. But how do we treat liars? Do we torture them and crucify them? That's what they deserve. I just don't buy it. I mean, that's cruel, that's wicked, you know. And I don't see that makes logical sense, and I don't see that it makes emotional sense to say that. Well, we all deserve what happened to Jesus because we're all so terrible, and so then God did it to him, and he was satisfied. And you know, well, then you say, well, what is the power of the death, and what was the point of the death at all? And I would say, no, I don't see that there's a point in the death, except insofar as he had to die to be resurrected. And the resurrection is something I can point to as being, you know, a positive sign of hope, you know, and a seal of God's promises. But the death itself is something that I look at as being, you know, what did Jesus say when he was being taken away from the garden? He said, this is your hour and the power of darkness. You know, and then they proceeded to mock him and torture him and crucify him. And when I look at that event, I don't see it as being, whoa, that was so great. You know, I mean, it was a necessary event so that we could learn that all of that power of darkness is completely, completely meaningless and powerless. But yeah, I mean, the first point that I made about substitutionary atonement, I'm just curious how you guys think about that.
Yeah, that's a really big question, which we're not going to be able to answer in the time we've got left here. Can I ask you a question so that in the future, as we're interacting with this, I have a better picture of where you're coming from? Do you believe in? I don't want to say hell, because there are different ways of, but do you believe in condemnation, that God will ultimately either destroy or punish or something like that those who are his enemies?
Well, yes and no. You talk about justice and you talk about mercy, you know, and Paul says mercy will triumph over justice, you know, and when I think about justice, I understand the concept that you cannot have, you know, you cannot have righteousness without justice. You cannot have goodness without justice. You know, and people talk about, well, let's just have peace in this world. Peace, peace. You can't have peace without justice. You cannot. You know, people have real demands. People have real desires for goodness. And without getting rid of this evil in some way, you cannot have that peace. But how do you get rid of the evil? Do you get rid of the evil by constantly torturing somebody? Or do you get rid of the evil by putting somebody in some terrible place? You know, I mean, it seems to me that the popular concept of hell, you know, and the popular conception of eternal torment doesn't provide peace at all because...
Yeah, can I interrupt, though? We're going to run out of time here. It was my mistake to bring up hell. I'm talking about a bigger concept here. I guess I'm asking if you're a universalist, is the way I would ask the question. Do you believe that some will be, whatever it might be, if it's not eternal torment, destroyed, killed, rejected in some way, or in the end, will everybody be together?
I hope it's the latter. I hope an eternal, universal salvation, but it's not my decision.
Okay. Right. Well, we can agree. I agree with that. That would be the place to start talking, because ultimately, if that's the question as to whether God intends, whether justice demands some sort of retribution, then we could talk about the extent to which Jesus' death pictures retribution or whatever. But if we don't believe that ultimately retribution is an appropriate or godly thing to do, then that would have to change the way we look at the cross, for sure. But that, I think that's probably as far as we could go. What? Yeah, did you?
When I begin teaching in March, before I get back into Luke, I think I'll take a week or two on the question, was it necessary for Jesus to die? And I will address both my theory of the atonement, and I'll try to remember to address your question then. It's one thing, I have to make a distinction. It's difficult for me to look at what happened to Jesus and in the raw facts of it and emotionally say, yes, I deserve that. I mean, it's hard to believe any human being could at an emotional level. I have to get more abstract in order for me to say yes to that. But I do think that's important, to make a distinction between what I grasp cognitively and what I'm willing to feel emotionally about that. I mean, it was just so incredibly cruel what happened to Jesus that how can anyone embrace that? It was an evil that was done to him. So, I don't find anything good about it emotionally and psychologically. But cognitively, have I come to believe about myself and assess myself such that at least I understand that a just God who's pure in his demand of justice might actually think that I need to be destroyed given the nature of my moral standing? Yeah, I think that. And that's the basis for my view. But I'll spell it out in a couple months.